Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few days after Christmas in 2010, NPR senior strategist Andy Carvin had been following a hashtag on Twitter about protests in a Tunisian city. Andy tweeted this, "Wonder what the chances of all this leading to a jasmine revolution? Don't know." Within 10 months, civil uprisings had erupted in countries throughout the Middle East and North Africa, and despotic regimes in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen had been toppled. Carvin tweeted and retweeted throughout, up to 1,500 times a day, and helped connect protesters on the streets of Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Libya, Yemen, and Syria with millions of onlookers worldwide, documenting a revolution in news gathering along with a political revolution. He writes about that experience in a new book called Distant Witness, part memoir, part history, and part primer on the bucking bronco that social media has ridden in journalism. And Andy joins us now from his room in Austin, where he's eagerly awaiting the start of South by Southwest. Andy Carvin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So I'm just imagining you there, @ACarvin, sitting at your computer, watching your Twitter feed, watching the action. When did you know that it was the moment to seize on what was going on in the Middle East?
Well, when I started seeing tweets from bloggers that I knew in Tunisia, it struck me as interesting because I'd spent time in Tunisia about 5 years prior to that, and I knew that freedom of expression and freedom of assembly had never been allowed there, at least under the current regime. And the fact that these protests were spreading from one city to another and spreading through social media really caught my attention, and so I began tweeting about it, trying to talk to people who were there, getting native Arabic speakers to help me translate some of the things that were coming through. And by the time that their president was overthrown in mid-January 2011, I almost immediately started seeing tweets and Facebook messages from Arab protest groups across the region, essentially saying, RSVP, save the date. We're going to have a revolution on February 14th or February 17th. And so, you know, at that time, it wasn't clear where all this was going to go, but it was unlike anything I had seen before. So I basically decided to hop along for the ride.
This book goes through each country, watching the revolution in real time, sharing some of the lessons that you learned along the way, some quite painful. I wonder if the countries themselves and the nature of the protests, Egypt, Libya, Syria, as things moved on, did they build on each other? Did they learn their own lessons about using social media?
I think they did, though in some cases it took a while. In the case of both Egypt and Tunisia, neither of their governments really understood the power of social media. The Mubarak regime, for example, tried shutting down the internet for a few days, and that kind of blew up in their faces. And the Tunisian government didn't know how to do much except try to find people's passwords and block a few websites here and there. By the time you get to countries like Bahrain, the governments are getting rather aggressive in using social media to get their messages out and to demonize the protesters. And then finally, by the time you get to a country like Syria, the government has essentially large groups of volunteers known as the Syrian Electronic Army that hack into people's computers and social media accounts in order to spy on what the opposition is doing. And so you can definitely see this pattern of sophistication increasing one government after the other as the revolutions went by.
In your book, you write about some of this cast of characters in very, you know, intimate ways, I think, stories of their lives. And these are people connecting with you through shared videos and tweets and emails, but that you never met, which is a big risk, you know, when using the citizen journalist. And you are, again, quite candid about mistakes that you made in the book. Any lessons that you'd like to share right off the bat?
Well, some of the main lessons I learned were more reminding myself having to put myself into the position of the people there and look through their particular culture. So, for example, there was a case where I received a video of a toddler in Libya who appeared to be getting ready for surgery. It looked like they were washing him up and getting him ready to go into the operating room. And it was only after I tweeted it that I realized through the help of some of my Twitter followers that it was actually a child who had been killed and they were preparing the body for burial. Now, of course, I knew that. I knew that about Muslim culture and that the way they washed the body prior to burial. And perhaps it was because it was such a horrific day and so many civilians had died that day that I really wanted this kid to be alive. And in fact, when I watched the video, I really could have sworn I saw the boy twitch a bit. But when I went back and watched it again, I realized it was just one of the people who was washing and they moved his arm a bit.
Well, that's one of the things that you did so effectively, mobilized others to help you check facts. I'm thinking of one a case of the Syrian blogger Amina, who was tweeting as gay girl in Damascus or writing as gay girl in Damascus. Eventually,
right.
You exposed him as a man named Tom McMaster.
Well,
how'd you find that out?
Yeah, well, I and a group of many people were involved. It wasn't solely me, though I was one of the first people to raise questions about their identity. Amina Araf was the name of a blogger who ran a blog called Gay Girl in Damascus, and she'd been getting a lot of press through mainstream media. Some news outlets even said that they had interviewed her in person, which gave her more credibility. But then at one point in June 2011, she was supposedly kidnapped, and her supporters around the world rallied to her cause. And I began asking questions if anyone knew her in person, simply because I wanted to learn more about her. And the more deeply I probed into it, the more I realized that no one had ever met her in person, not even her online girlfriend. And as I began reaching out to the news organizations that had interviewed her, I discovered that they too hadn't met her either. And so suddenly this race was on to figure out whether or not she was just deeply in the closet, or was she some sort of government mole, or was she a hoax? And ultimately, she was exposed to be an American grad student, a man living in Scotland, who had been playing this character online for many years.
We're speaking with the NPR senior strategist Andy Carvin. He's alternately been called a one-man Twitter news bureau, the man who tweets revolutions, Twitter Stravinsky. He's also known as @@ACarvin to Twitter followers all over the world. And we're talking with him about how social media changed news gathering and the role he played in that revolution during the Arab Spring. Well, Andy, you did really grab this tiger by the tail. And I'm wondering about your reflections now on countries in transition after the so-called Arab Spring, noticing the rise of extremism over secularism in some countries, economic fallout, inter-ethnic or inter-religious violence. Now, you were kind of in it. You were kind of on the ground in your own way. Are you disappointed in the way that these things have turned out?
I don't think it's a matter of being disappointed or not disappointed. I think there's no doubt that the people on the ground who were involved in these revolutions, many of them are quite disappointed. But, you know, if you think about the way revolutions play out in general, like, or any type of major geopolitical change, if you go back to the fall of the Berlin Wall over 20 years ago now, at the time it seemed like all of these countries in Eastern Europe that were affected were suddenly going to be Jeffersonian democracies. Some of those made the transition, but others, such as Belarus, did not. And so I think we're just at the beginning of a process of watching these countries reach the next level of their evolution. And it's certainly not going without bumps for a lot of them. Egypt's government has been in one crisis after another. Tunisia, which seemed very stable for a while, is having its own problems as of late. And so I don't think it's very easy to say whether or not these revolutions have been successful or if they've failed. They've started the transition from one type of country to another, but it's probably going to take at least a generation before we truly know how successful these were.
Andy, new analysis from the Pew Research Center suggests that dialogue on Twitter does not reflect public opinion at large. And I'm wondering what you know about the demographics of Twitter and how the demographic does affect the type of news reporting that you do.
Well, I don't look to Twitter as something I would use for polling, especially something like political polling, because clearly it's being used by people who can afford internet access, especially mobile broadband, and that certainly makes the demographics of it different than the general population to a certain extent. And you could certainly see that play out in places like Tahrir Square, where only about maybe a third of the Egyptian population has internet access. And so if you're following people on Twitter in Tahrir Square and they're tweeting in English, you can be pretty sure that they're among the elites of the population. But having said that, they're also the ones that are uploading footage and streaming live videos and are scattered about the various parts of the field of battle. And so in some situations, their status in terms of the country's demographics don't matter as much as the fact that they are eyewitnesses at that particular moment. And so if you can parse through that information and sort through it and verify it as best you can, then you potentially have some powerful stories you can get out of it.
Andy Carvin, NPR senior strategist and author of the new book, Distant Witness. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First book I've read that uses mostly tweets in its sources. You can find out more about the book at wordofmouthradio.org or follow Andy on Twitter at acarvin.